Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it feel like to be the Queen of England? 2012 marks the 60th anniversary of the reign of Elizabeth II, who became queen when she was just 26 years old following the sudden death of her father. As only the second British monarch in centuries to hold the throne for so long, Elizabeth has seen a dozen prime ministers come and go, presided over literally thousands of official events, and been present as her country and the world have changed in countless ways. These days, she even has a cell phone and a Twitter account. So what does the role of Queen mean to Elizabeth, and how has it affected her personal life? Biographer Sally Bedell Smith is here to talk about that. She's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine and author of the new book Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. Sally, welcome to THINK.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here.
You've actually met the Queen on a couple of occasions, and it seems that in person she is a lot warmer than we might assume having seen her on television.
She is. I had three personal encounters with her at private events. She does not give interviews. When the press follows her around, they're very much kept at a distance. But even before I was asked to write the book by Random House, I met the Queen at a garden party at the British Ambassador's residence here in Washington, and I watched her have a very spirited conversation with my husband about the Kentucky Derby that she had just seen for the first time. Of course, she loves horses, breeding horses and horse racing, and my husband knows a little bit about what happens during a horse race. So she immediately, what was interesting is that he started out by asking her a rather rude question. You're not really supposed to ask the Queen a question, and he asked her not only asked her a question, but he asked her if she bet on the race, which she studiously ignored. But it was interesting because there was something about the way he asked it that kind of piqued her interest. So the two of them just kind of replayed the race. And what I saw in that very brief window was, I saw her sparkling eyes and I saw her animated gestures and her big smile and this kind of enthusiasm that you don't typically see when you see her in her public role, which is, you know, very sort of staid and walking slowly with her handbag on her arm. So it was a kind of a little revelation to me, and I tucked it away. I remembered a friend of ours who's a British artist who painted her portrait back in the late 1980s had said that he was so surprised by her private side. He said she waves her hands all around. She talks like an Italian. But then, so 9 months later, when I was asked to write the book to come out at the time of her celebrating her Diamond Jubilee, 60 years on the throne, I just jumped at the chance, and I thought, wow, there's obviously so much to learn about this woman who's been in everybody's lives really for six decades. You know, four generations have known this queen and have watched her grow from, you know, an ingenue in her 20s, becoming this young queen with little children, to kind of wise middle age, to becoming the grandmother that everybody loves. And as it turned out, not only did I find out an enormous amount about her range of duties, I mean, she's so far from being a figurehead, but also that private side, that those character traits that you expect her to be, you know, to be dutiful and disciplined and all that, but you don't expect the kind of spontaneity and the joie de vivre and the sense of humor and the earthiness and that she has when she's in her private moments with friends and with family. And the other two times that I met her, at both at receptions, private receptions at St. James's Palace, she was also very relaxed. At the second one, I'd been working on the book for about a year, and she knew that I was working on the book, but it was not obviously the sort of thing that she would acknowledge in that kind of a setting. Mm-hmm. But I was picked out among about 100 people to be introduced to her, and she asked me why I had come to England, and I said, well, my daughter's getting married over here to an Englishman. And she said, oh, when's the wedding date? And I said, the 4th of July. And she said, oh, that's a little dangerous. So there was just this sparkle of wit that popped out. And the third time I saw her was right before, about a month before, the wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton. And it was a party that was given by one of her cousins also at St. James's Palace. A large group of people, but a more relaxed atmosphere than I had seen before, because there were a lot of members of her family there and a lot of friends were there. And she just, typically in those receptions, she's got a little phalanx of courtiers, of equerries and ladies-in-waiting who are around to kind of introduce her to people, and it's all very sort of systematically done. But on this day, she was literally just sort of wandering around the crowd. I mean, you would have had to look twice to figure out which one in the room was the queen. And what struck me at the time, because I knew a little bit more, I mean, I knew quite a bit more about her from having talked to so many people, but was her, here she was, this was her palace. You know, this was St. James's Palace, this ancient palace that belongs to the queen. And she was, you know, she was just a guest. And it was a kind of measure of this humility that quite a few people mentioned to me as one of her surprising traits.
You know, the interesting thing to me in reading this book is the idea that being queen is as much a burden as a blessing. And people forget now that she was not, in fact, born to be queen.
No, she was not. The expectation was that her uncle, King Edward VIII, who took the throne at the beginning of 1936 when her grandfather, King George V, died, the expectation was that he would marry and he would have children and that they would be next in line to the throne. But, of course, at the end of that year, he abdicated the throne and her father became King George VI. And he, you know, he was, although he was theoretically in line, I mean, he was in line, he was in the line of succession, he didn't think that it would come to him, and so he was quite unprepared for it, and when he heard the news, he wept to his mother and said, you know, I've just been trained to be a naval officer. Hmm. But at that moment, when he became king, she became the heiress presumptive. She didn't become the heir to the throne, because there was always the possibility that her parents could have a son who would leapfrog her in the line of succession. In fact, it wasn't a practical possibility because her mother had had two cesarean sections. Both Elizabeth and her younger sister Margaret were born by cesarean section, and so it was considered too dangerous to have a third one back then. So she was the one, and when she heard the news from a footman, her sister said, so that means you'll be the next queen. And Lilibet, as she was known in the family, said, yes, yes, I guess, yes, it does. And Margaret said, poor you. Hmm. And what she was thinking of was, even at that young age, the knowledge that this is a job for life, and that the coronation in June of 1953, more than a year after she took the throne, she made a solemn vow, a sacred vow, and was anointed by holy oil. It's a very deeply religious ceremony, and she was recognized as God's representative of her people, and with the obligation to serve her people until she died. This is something she has said repeatedly over the years. It's a job for life. She renewed that vow last week when she actually marked the milestone of 60 years on the throne, only the second monarch in the history of the British monarchy to do so, her great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, being the other. But, you know, it's not, she doesn't ever give the sense that it's a burden. She accepted it as her destiny. She felt that even though she took the throne at an earlier time than she ever anticipated. Even though her father had been ill, she didn't think she would become queen when she was that young. But she said at one point when she was sort of ruminating about it, she said, you know, it's all a matter of training. And she was, in fact, trained very well by her father and by a tutor that they hired for her who worked with her very closely for 6 years, studying the intricacies of the British Constitution, which are quite unfathomable to us who have our written Constitution. And also she studied a lot of world history. She studied American history. So she came to the throne being quite prepared. In fact, her first prime minister, Winston Churchill, was struck by how quickly she adapted, how conscientious and well-informed she was, and then how within days of taking the throne she was receiving prime ministers and presidents, and she was doing it all very faultlessly. He said he was struck by her attentiveness, that she was absolutely attentive to everything she did. One of her archbishops of Canterbury, George Carey, described her role as glad service. And I think that's an interesting way of putting it. She just, it is something that was bestowed upon her, and she has done it with incredible dedication. You know, she's almost 86 years old, and she still has a very, very heavy schedule of obligations, both, you know, work in the palace. She does 3 or 4 hours a day reading government documents and having audiences with everybody from the prime minister to generals, to judges, to senior officials in the church, ambassadors from her own country and overseas. And I guess, you know, one of the many surprises that I discovered in writing this book is how much all these people rely on her when they go to their audiences, that here she is, particularly now, she has this accumulated knowledge and wisdom acquired over 60 years. She's seen every sensitive government document. She's traveled the length and breadth of the United Kingdom and all over the world many times over, and has known every head of state. So they recognize that she is an unparalleled resource that they can rely on.
Will you remind us, Sally, of the official role of the British royal family vis-a-vis the running of the country and the official elected government?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the executive power belongs to the government, the party in power and its prime minister. They run the government. And her role is, as it's really divided in two. It's as head of state, representing her country at home and abroad, acting always on the advice of her government. When she meets with her prime minister and others, she doesn't specifically give them advice. She has a very specific set of functions in that role, which is the right to be consulted and to encourage and to warn. Mm-hmm. So she asks lots of questions, and of her 12 prime ministers, they're all unanimous in saying that she gets them to think things through, to get to think twice about decisions. She may not alter their decisions, but she is an invaluable perspective. So there's that head of state aspect, but she's also the head of nation, which means that she maintains a very close bond with her subjects. Hearing, understanding their concerns, and she does that in several ways. She reads a lot of correspondence, and she also, as I say, she travels and she talks to people from all walks of life.
Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. My guest is biographer Sally Vidal Smith. Her new book is called Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is biographer Sally Bedell Smith. She's contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine and author of the new book, Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Sally, earlier when we were talking about the Queen's coronation, you alluded to the fact that she sees it as an almost religious obligation to serve her country in this way. What role does faith play in her life?
Faith plays a very big role in her life. She is, of course, the supreme governor of the Church of England, which is a very important role, and she has to approve, for example, the appointment of all the senior clerics in the Anglican Church. But on a personal level, she is deeply religious, and yet she wears it quite lightly. She does not flaunt her faith, but it informs the way she goes about her life. I think the Archbishop of Canterbury who said to me, you know, she can take anything that the world throws at her. She has an understanding that there are certain things that she can do something about and certain things she can't do something about. And she has this extraordinary equanimity that derives both from her faith and from her life experience. When she was a young girl, her mother, who was also her mother, used to, you know, every night say her prayers on her knees. And the Queen, in all likelihood, has done the same. But her mother taught her, you know, all the Psalms and all the collects. The Anglican clerics that I talked to said she knows the Book of Common Prayer backwards and forwards. Her main outlet for expressing the values of her Christian faith is her yearly Christmas address, and she often speaks in terms of her faith when she gives that address. Not in any kind of an overwhelming way, but it does inform those addresses.
I was interested to read that her contributions to the church are modest, to say the least. Financial contributions, I should say.
Well, at least what she carries in her handbag. They're all very meticulously folded 5-pound and 10-pound notes. it's entirely likely that she contributes something far more than that beyond, but certainly in that handbag, which everybody seems to ask me about.
How strange to have your face on the currency that you carry even once a week.
Yes, I think it's probably just something she's accustomed to. It's her face is everywhere. It's on the currency. It's on the stamps. But and as a consequence of being the Queen, of course, she doesn't have a passport. And the first private visit she made to the United States in 1984 when she came to Kentucky, you know, she's been to this country really a surprising number of times. She's been here 11 times, and 5 of those were private holidays, much of which had to do with her equine, her horses. But she arrived in Kentucky, and she did have a State Department protocol officer assigned to her to meet her, but the passport official wouldn't let her in the country because she didn't have a passport. So they had to make some very quick calls to the State Department and smooth that one over.
So talk about this. She does have a way with animals that is really very fond, and she almost has a gift for communicating with them.
She does. One of her most unusual friends is a man named, she has quite a few American friends, and a man named Monty Roberts, who is known as, he's a California cowboy, and he's known as one of the horse whisperers. And she befriended him in 1989 because she was interested in the way that he trained horses, not by breaking them in the kind of classically brutal way that it's always been done, but by starting them in this very gentle way. And she invited him to come to Windsor Castle and demonstrate this technique to many, many skeptical horse trainers and grooms and so forth. And she could see the wisdom of it. And he, you know, he got to know her very well, and he said quite a few insightful things about her understanding. She understands the psychology of horses. She gets into it, and she wants to investigate their innate tendencies. And one of her stud grooms once said she gets horses psychologically attuned to what she wants, and then she persuades them. But Monty said that she had, he even compared kind of her own character traits to the horses that she spent so much time with. He said she, like a horse, has an incredible ability to read intention. And from a very early age, she got to know all the intricacies of the bloodlines of her horses, and it really is almost a professional in that sense. She, in her role as queen, she has to take advice all the time, but in her role as the owner and breeder of horses, she makes all of the decisions on her own, including the naming. And, you know, people say, oh, well, as queen, she can't be very imaginative. She has all these routines she has to go through all the time, and she deals with, you know, all these duties. But in fact, maybe because she loves word games, she loves charades, and she's a real whiz at jigsaw puzzles and Scrabble and games like that, but she has this knack for naming horses in very imaginative ways. I mean, the one that comes to mind is there was one that she called Lost Marbles, and the sire was the dame was Amnesia, and the sire was Lord Elgin. And you know, she came up with that, and she's done quite a few of those over the years, and people are always struck by how imaginative she can be.
Is it going too far to say she struggled more to be very natural and understand the intentions of her own children?
Well, I think her she had challenges with motherhood and somewhat mitigated by the fact that she, you know, when she became queen, she was 25 years old, and she had a 3-year-old and an 18-month-old, and it's hard, you know, this was 1952, and this was not a world where women were very prevalent. Mm-hmm. It was a world, both in government and in her own household, that was run by aristocratic men. She, you know, she really made it a point, and Churchill noticed how hard she was working, of establishing her worthiness as a serious monarch. And she did have all these duties that were thrown at her. So she was, I think, if there is a criticism of her, she was somewhat distant from her children. Of course, like many women of her class, she had nannies, most of whom were very nurturing. She had her own mother who was widowed and was a very doting grandmother. So she did have people around her to take up the slack. Of the four children, I'd say Charles is probably the most sensitive and had the greatest yearning for more contact with his mother, more signs of approval. But they've in more recent years, I think they've established a very good relationship. That I think was difficult for her, and she really had no other women to talk to about that. It was not something that women, particularly professional women, spoke about.
We have an email here from Tony in Plano, who's curious about why it took 16 months after the death of King George before Elizabeth was officially crowned.
It really had to do with the massive organization that was required for it. The logistics of the coronation are truly impressive. And they also had to wait a certain period of time before, of mourning the king. But it had to do mostly with getting it all organized.
And she actually had to practice wearing that very heavy crown on her head.
She practiced. She put, not yes, the crown that is put on the head of the monarch at the coronation is only used for that occasion. It's a 5-pound crown.
Hmm.
And she was, and she still is, a fairly diminutive woman. She didn't weigh all that much. And between the crown at 5 pounds and the weight of her heavily gilded vestments, they weighed 36 pounds, plus her scepter and her orb. She was literally standing there with 45 pounds worth of regalia. I'm amazed she didn't fall over. But she did practice in Buckingham Palace with sheets that were tied together and weighted down with lead, so she would get accustomed to it.
Do you think it's lonely for her?
Well, I think she is in such a unique position. I don't think she's lonely, but there is a solitude inherent in being the queen because there's really nobody else like her, and there is a kind of invisible wall around her as a consequence. Even her family members and her closest friends have to curtsy or bow to her when they greet her and when they say goodbye to her. I talked to a good number of her friends, and they said she is a wonderful friend. She takes a great interest in them and their children, and she'll listen to them if they talk about their problems, although they know that they have to be very judicious in the kinds of problems they bring to her because they don't want to, they don't want to overstep. So, she has lots of friends, many of whom are members of her extended family. And in a sense that she can, as one of them said, doesn't have the kind of friendship where you can sort of sit down on the sofa together and just get cozy and chatty. And there's always a little bit of a dividing line that everybody's aware of, even her children. I imagine that probably the one person that penetrates that isolation is Philip.
Mm-hmm.
As one of her former private secretaries said that, he's the one person who can treat her like a real human being, and he's the only person to whom she can just say, shut up. She can't really say that to anybody else.
Can he say it back to her?
Oh, yes, absolutely. He can, yes.
I guess being married for 65 years, you've got to say it once or twice.
I think, yeah. No, I mean, there's some very funny vignettes, anecdotes in the book about little moments of a conflict between them, not terrible conflict. There was a time after Diana and Charles's wedding when one of the Queen's cousins had a big party at Claridge's, and the Queen and Philip were dancing all night, and they had a final time. Lester Lannan was playing, and he was handing out all those beanies that he hands out when he's there, and multicolored beanies. And at one point, Philip put one of the beanies on his head as they were walking out the door, and the wife of the American ambassador was witnessing this, and the Queen was furious with him because she just thought it was so undignified, and he absolutely resisted her. No, I'm not taking it off. I'm not taking it off. And he finally did, and they got in the car, and he whipped it back on his head.
You do, especially in portraits like that and in thinking about her commitment to duty throughout her entire life, you do have to sort of sympathize with her when her children and other members of the family are not as disciplined as she with regard to the sobriety required to carry out their roles.
I think that's accurate. And she did have a rough couple of decades in the 80s and 90s when 3 of her 4 children had marriages that quite publicly fell apart. It wasn't something that she talked about at any great length. But at one point, she was talking to one of her cousins, and she said, "How could I have two?" She was talking about Fergie and Diana, 2 daughters-in-law who misbehave like this. And it was a frustration to her. Of course, she wanted she's always wanted her children to be happy in their marriages, and it was a source of great anguish to her. the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time, George Carey, told me that at one point he had a very serious conversation with her about the terrible problems that Charles and Diana were having, and she got a sort of look of anguish on her face, and she said, "Oh, I'm just so worried that history might be repeating itself." And he said he saw despair on her face, and of course she was referring back to the Duke and Duchess of Windsor when the then King Edward VIII gave up the throne. Now Charles obviously wasn't on the throne; she was on the throne, but she was worried that he was possibly, by giving up Diana and marrying Camilla — this was back in the early 90s when the church wasn't so relaxed about this — that he would be throwing everything out the window.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Stephen on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. Yes, I recently read Miss Beadle Smith's book once. I'm glad to read it another two times because I'm a retired pastor and teacher, and I'm preparing a book review on it here in Dallas.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad you've read it so many times. That's lovely to hear.
And I have spoken on the royal family before, and it's a particular interest of mine. I found so many new facts I didn't know, fascinating facts. I was particularly interested in her knowledge of American history. I do have dual nationality myself, so I found that really interesting. And how she talked about the special relationship going to the essential relationship.
Yeah.
And also duty. Growing up, that was kind of hammered into me as well in England. And I had met George Carey here, and I had corresponded with him back in England. And I found that aspect of his relationship as pastor and mentor for the Queen fascinating also.
Stephen,
oh, good.
Thank you so much for
delighted
your call.
Delighted to hear all that.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute with Sally Bedell Smith. She's the biographer and author of Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sally Bedell Smith. She's contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine and author of the new book Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have a phone open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Sally, Queen Elizabeth has definitely changed the fiscal policy of the monarchy in Great Britain. Can you talk a little bit about her attitudes about money?
Well, it's striking that that in the last 10 years she's really run a very tight ship at Buckingham Palace. She, in the mid 80s, ordered a really top-to-bottom study of how the whole household spent its money and instituted hundreds of reforms without firing anybody, but really increased the efficiency of how they operate. And several governments have certainly made note of that. And in recent years, obviously, as the economy has struggled, she has accepted funding freezes, really, and has significantly cut back in some of her entertaining. There's a new way of supporting the royal household that's about to kick in a year or two. But in the interim, she has accepted a freeze, and it's. You know, when George Osborne, David Cameron's Chancellor of the Exchequer, presented it last year, he made note of of how, you know, how well run, really, the compared to some of the other government departments, the royal household was. She's always been frugal. She was taught personally to be frugal from the time she was a little girl. And Philip is the same way. I was talking to the woman who used to run Blair House, the president's guest house across the street from the White House, where the Queen and Philip have stayed any number of times. And she noticed during one visit that Philip spent quite a bit of time walking around flipping off the lights, saying, "What a waste! What a waste!"
You know, it's funny because it's recognizable to people who are part of the sort of WASP culture of the United States.
Right.
That same attitude: where you may have plenty of money, but you don't. There's no need to waste it.
Yeah, and they do because of the vast heritage of the royal family accumulated over 1,000 years. They obviously live in these extraordinary palaces and have priceless art collections and jewel collections, but they really don't, you know, the Queen has her own personal collections, but those collections belong to the country, and they are stewards of them, and they take that stewardship very, very seriously.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Ian in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Hello again. Yes, I'd like to ask the author, how aware is the Queen of the fading popularity in the British public over the last, four decades?
Well, she has been, her popularity level, when they started measuring it back in 1969, and it the number of people in the population who wanted to see the monarchy abolished and a republic, substituting for it, was about a little less than 20% of the population, and that has remained astonishingly consistent over the years. At this stage, the whole Republican movement has kind of gone underground because the Queen is more popular than ever, and the monarchy's in a very good place. Obviously, the difficulties that Diana and Charles had, you know, were a tough time for not only for them but for the monarchy, and certainly the week after Diana's death, when the Queen, for all the right reasons, by the way, decided to stay up at Balmoral to take care of the princes William and Harry to prepare them for the funeral, but she was criticized for not coming to London to show support for the million people who had poured into the city to grieve over Diana. She couldn't quite understand it, but eventually she did see that her insistence on staying up at Balmoral was beginning to hurt the monarchy itself, so she did come. She was very responsive once she realized the consequences. So at that point, the sort of support for the monarchy dipped a little bit, but after she gave the speech on the eve of Diana's funeral, and it was such a compassionate and authentic speech, that the popularity bounced right up again.
What sort of grandmother is she?
I'll tell you, she's been a wonderful grandmother. You know, I guess this happens with grandmothers, but in her case, she has really taken an interest in all of her grandchildren, particularly William and Harry as the second and third in line to the throne. When both of them went to school, unlike Charles, they went to school very near Windsor Castle at Eton College, so she regularly invited them up to tea, and has taken a real hand in William's upbringing. I thought it was fascinating that about 3 years ago, not Charles, but the Queen, hired one of the most experienced Foreign Service veterans to be a sort of mentor and guide to William and Harry and now Kate. She recognizes that Charles is obviously going to succeed her when she dies, and that may not be for another decade. Who knows? She's in very good shape. But she does know, as David Cameron, the Prime Minister, said, that, that William and Catherine are the team of the future. And so it's, you know, that to her is, that is the you know, the long-term future of the monarchy is in their hands. And as a consequence, she has spent a lot of time. You know, and also it's interesting to see that all those, that whole generation of grandchildren have all married commoners. Some of them, you know, people like the daughter of Princess Anne, Zara Phillips, married Mike Tyndall, who's a rugby player and from a very modest background. And Kate herself is from a modest background, had parents, you know, her great grandfather worked in the mines in Durham, and her parents were self-made people, kind of up by the bootstraps, built a business. The Queen accepts that the fact that the royal family, to maintain its, you know, its connection to the people, has to move with the times, and she has embraced all the choices and is very close to all the the husbands and wives of that generation that have come into the family.
There have been people who've speculated that Queen Elizabeth might have abdicated early in favor of her son Charles had he not been so tied up in scandal for so many years. But you don't necessarily agree with that.
Oh, I don't agree in the least. She, you know, as I mentioned earlier, when she went through the coronation, and now that I've immersed myself and understand all the ramifications of it, I do appreciate the fact that she is in a job for life, and it is a solemn vow that she took. It's probably not that easy as an octogenarian to do all the things she does. She still does over 400 engagements a year. They've paced herself very well. They're mindful of her age, and when she celebrates this Diamond Jubilee year, unlike her Golden Jubilee 10 years ago, she's not going to travel overseas. She traveled overseas last October and went to Australia, but she is deputizing her grandchildren and her children to represent her overseas, although she has a very full schedule, she and Philip. He's 90, remember, and they're going to be traveling all over the U.K.
Are there different, greater concessions to security today than there were even a decade or so ago?
You know, I suppose there are, but they're invisible. And I've traveled with the Queen and Prince Philip around the U.K. and overseas, and it's I guess it was most, the differences were most stark when I went with them to Ground Zero in July of 2010, and it's not that her personal protection officers are relaxed. They're not. They're very vigilant, but they're not as sort of uptight and rigid as the Secret Service is now. You know, and the Queen has been attacked. Back in the early 80s, she was riding at the head of her birthday parade on horseback, side saddle, and a madman in the crowd rang out with six shots. They were blanks, but I watched the footage over and over. She was unbelievably unflappable. She just kind of focused on calming her horse. She's, you know, she rides around in open carriages all the time. She's sort of, as somebody who worked with her said, she's sort of fatalistic about it. She knows there's a line of succession. She obviously wants to be well protected, but she doesn't want to lose contact with her people. She once said, I have to be seen to be believed. So she wants to be visible. She wants to go out and do walkabouts, and she wants to be in carriages. And that's, you know, she's very physically courageous. I have a number of incidents in the book that illustrate that. One was when she was with one of her horse trainers, and looking at a bunch of her year-old colts, and they suddenly started rearing up, what they called dive bombing, all around her, and she was with five other people, and three of them absolutely fled for the gate, and she and her trainer just stood there stock still, because getting back to her understanding of horses, she knew that if she just remained calm, that they would settle down and they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't trample on her. But it required a bit of nerve, and she turned to the trainer afterwards and she said, "That was a little scary, wasn't it?"
Is there any way to know, Sally, whether she's ever wished for a different life for herself?
Well, no, there isn't. Others, you know, there are lots of other people who said, well, if she hadn't been the heiress presumptive, she would have lived a perfectly happy life as a countrywoman. She loves the country life, and she spends a lot of time in the country. She goes for 6 weeks in the winter up to Sandringham in Norfolk, and then for 2 months in the autumn up to Balmoral. It is probably where she is happiest. She loves being out on horseback, which she still does.
Without a helmet.
Without a helmet, yes. And I got the explanation for that first time from one of her trainers, and who said he was riding with her one day at Windsor, and said, "Ma'am, you of all people should be wearing a hard hat." And she said, "You don't understand. You don't have to get your hair done the way I do." But it wasn't vanity. It was just she knew she had to be ready for her next engagement. So she wears that Hermes scarf. There's a joke at Windsor that the only thing that separates the queen from her heir is an Hermes scarf. But she does love the countryside, and she loves, obviously, the horses, and she loves having cattle, and she loves having a working farm, and she loves going out on shoots. And until she, you know, from the time she was 16 until she was 60, she stalked stag and would crawl on the ground through the undergrowth and the hills above Balmoral. She loves her working dogs. She can give them commands at 1,000 feet and have them go retrieve grouse and pheasants. So she is a countrywoman at heart. And there's a poem in the beginning of the book that sort of reflects on her isolation, or her solitude. It was written by Mary Wilson, the widow of one of her prime ministers, Harold Wilson, and it portrays her kind of in her element in the country.
Would any part of you wish to be queen for even a month, a year?
Sure.
Really? Just for the fun of it, for the grandeur?
Yeah. I've been to Buckingham Palace. I've been to I was lucky to go to dinner there, not invited by the Queen, but mm-hmm. to dinner in the ballroom and the picture gallery, and to sit there and with this amazing George III silver gilt sculpted centerpieces and candelabra and footmen in royal livery serving the meals. And these are the rooms where she entertains heads of state. I mean, obviously, it's the responsibilities are vast, and the discipline is something that would be difficult to adhere to, but it would be fun for a month.
Sally Bedell-Smith's new book is called Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. Sally, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
You're welcome, Chris. I enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download that free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.